Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Jenny Dearborn. It's my pleasure to introduce Chris Anderson, author of TED Talks, the official TED Guide to Public Speaking. Chris is the head curator of TED. He was born in Pakistan and spent his childhood in India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. He later graduated from Oxford University with degrees in philosophy, politics, and economics. He's trained as a journalist and throughout his career has launched more than 100 successful magazines and websites. 15 years ago, he took over TED, expanding the TED stage as a place for thinkers and doers to share ideas, spark conversation, and encourage discovery. Everyone from Bono to Sheryl Sandberg to Malcolm Gladwell have graced the TED stage, and international online viewership is up over 1 billion per year. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Chris Anderson.
Thank you so much, Jenny. Hello, everyone. It's so nice to see you. Unfortunately, though, this first bit's just a little bit awkward. It's possible some of you are here under the assumption that the person who just published the official TED Guide to Public Speaking would himself be a great public speaker. So I need to tell you what happened in Pakistan a few years ago. It's the country I was born in. I went there to give a talk, and I was so excited afterwards to go online and read what my countrymen had said about it. Here was what I read. I had a moment of revelation after I saw this. It was that I actually didn't mind being a bad presenter. A bad presenter. That really hurt. But I'm afraid there's worse. I need to take you to the moment when I actually first appeared on the TED stage. I'm going to show you an image from that day. If you're feeling squeamish, please cover your eyes right now. Thank you. See, now, you are looking at a man who's trying to actually build a human connection with his audience while wearing a wrinkled T-shirt, sporting a dorky haircut, and so nervous he can't even stand up. So I think we're going to have to agree that I'm not a natural public speaker. And so when it came to writing this book, I kind of had to figure out how to turn this bug into a feature. So this is the argument. You ready? If this awkward plonker can learn to give an occasionally effective talk, anyone can, okay? And the funny thing is, even this cringeworthy talk did turn out to be surprisingly effective. And if I may, I'd like to tell you what happened that day, because it does illuminate what's at the core of the book and what I want to share tonight. So this was 2002. Back then, there were no TED Talks on the internet. TED was an annual conference. And this was 3 months or so after my foundation had purchased it from its founder, Richard Saul Wurman. Now, Ricky was a super charismatic figure. His personality infused every aspect of TED. And I discovered to my horror that most of the TED community didn't think TED was going to survive his departure. They assumed this was the last TED. TED was over. And when you looked at the bookings for the following year's conference, you could see it all too plainly right there. TED always sells out a year in advance, 800 people. This year, despite my best efforts, total number of ticket sales, 70. So I had one chance at this final conference of Ricky's to try and persuade people to come along for the ride, that it was going to be okay. I was feeling pretty sick, pretty nervous about it. But I took a deep breath, rolled my chair to the front of the stage, and started to make my case. And when I stopped speaking 15 minutes later, to my astonishment, a few people actually stood up and started clapping. And then suddenly, everyone was standing and clapping. And within an hour after this talk, 200 more people had paid the big bucks to sign up for the next year's conference. It was suddenly clear it was going to be okay. By the way, if it had gone the other way, I think Ted would have died 4 years before ever putting a talk on the internet. We would certainly not be here tonight. So how on earth did that happen? How did it happen? Well, several things. I mean, there were some basics that were right. I used my fear of this moment to prepare. It was motivation to prepare. I knew what I was going to say, and I spoke from the heart, and I spoke earnestly and with passion. And there was some kind of human connection based on a bit of humor and a story of the collapse of my business that I told and so forth. None of that was the real thing, though. I think what made the difference is that during that 15 minutes, a weird thing happened. A strange object germinated and grew inside the minds of people listening. That thing was an idea. In this case, specifically, the idea that the kind of cross-disciplinary knowledge that was shared at TED actually really mattered for the world, for collaboration, for innovation, could not be allowed to go away, so much so that I was going to convert TED into a nonprofit and run it for the public good. That idea persuaded people that it didn't matter that much if the host was charismatic. What mattered was they wanted to be part of TED's next chapter. And the broader point here is it's about the idea. It really always is. Your job as a speaker is not to be entertaining and tell stories and promote your organization and any of that stuff. It's to offer your audience a gift in the form of an idea that you teleport from your mind into theirs. And if you're successful, you have given them something that could impact their life literally years into the future. But what is an idea? Well, I mean, the ideas come in all shapes and sizes. They range from the complex to the aesthetic. It's anything that changes your worldview and impacts how you respond to what you see in the world. So here are some ideas that have been shared on the TED stage in the past. They may look familiar to you. And you know, if you could literally see what an idea looks like in your mind, you would see a tangle of probably millions of neurons, literally. And the fact that that entire pattern can be transferred into receiving minds in the course of a few minutes strikes me as an absolute miracle. I mean, how on earth can that even happen? Well, the truth is, it doesn't always happen. It's hard for it to happen. Most talks are actually a bust. If I may, I'm going to share with you a TED talk I found on the internet, albeit in this case it's Ted Poe. He's a fine congressman. But this day, things didn't exactly go according to plan.
It is an honor to once again sponsor.
You know, a little tip you won't find in the book. If you're going to give a talk on a really important topic on live TV, don't put your grandson in the row right behind you. Just don't do that. The poor kid. But this poor kid stands for all of us, all those talks we sat through in business and university and church and, you know, it doesn't have to be boring. But how do you break through boring to get to the actual idea transfer bit? Well, there's actually no one way to do it. Every speaker, every topic, every audience, every venue is different. There are no rules here. There is absolutely no formula. What there are tools. Tools that you can pick from and tools that are actually teachable. And if I may, what I'd like to do is just show you a few of those tools in action. I mean, here's one. look, you don't have to spend the first few minutes thanking everyone inside and declaring how deeply honored and excited you are to be at the venue. You just don't have to. We're living in an attention war, unfortunately, and your players in it. You hold in your pockets lethal weapons called smartphones. If you pull those out, you know, I'm dead, actually. And by the way, the four people behind you are also dead. I mean, you've got to try and grab people from the get-go. So how do you do that? Well, here's Maysoon Zaid in action. Now, she's a comedian. She suffers from cerebral palsy due to a botched medical procedure at her birth. And when she came onto the TED stage, she was literally shaking and swaying. But she started like this.
My name is Mason Zayed, and I am not drunk, but the doctor who delivered me was.
Boom! Right? She owns us after a single sentence. Here's BJ Miller from San Francisco, who's giving a talk about death, but started it with a jolt.
Well, we all need a reason to wake up. For me, it just took 11,000 volts.
11,000 volts. An incredible man, incredible talk. You know, artists can actually do this as well.
May I take a closer look? There's more to this painting than meets the eye. And yes, it's a acrylic painting of a man, but I didn't paint it on canvas. I painted it directly on top of the man.
And at that point, you're in. So you've started your talk. What next? Oh, that's interesting. Sorry, just checking one thing. This is the moment that I do to give all the speakers out there a little gift. You know, there's glitches in every talk, and you know what? You actually don't care. You're going to forgive me any moment now. Before you can poke around inside people's minds, you kind of have to win their permission to do that, right? People don't like strangers doing that. So how do you do that? Well, you actually show them just a piece of who you are. How? Maybe anecdote, a little bit of humor, a little bit of vulnerability. Or you can just look at people. You know, your eyes actually have superpowers. When two humans look at each other, their minds are literally syncing. You can measure it in brainwaves. So don't give a talk looking down into your notes the whole time or projecting out above the audience where no one actually lives. You know, find a few friendly faces and talk conversationally to them because you will connect that way. And it's just really powerful when you do it that way. So you started, you maybe made a connection. Tell a story. How about that? Our minds are wired to love stories, and great stories can make or break so many a talk. So when Monica Lewinsky came to TED, she came under a mountain of fear because obviously, you know, the memories of the humiliation she'd suffered in her early 20s. When she got on stage, a single story worked some magic.
At the age of 41, I was hit on by a 27-year-old guy. He was charming, and I was flattered, and I declined. You know what his unsuccessful pickup line was? He could make me feel 22 again.
There you go. And with that, the rest of the talk, she's relaxed, the audience is relaxed, and it was an incredible home run, amazing talk. Now, stories don't just have to help everyone relax, though. They can actually also set up your idea. Here's Ernesto Siroli. You know, he was giving a talk on why listening is so important. And he started with a story showing what happens when you don't. The setting is a development aid project in a fertile valley in Zambia.
Everything in Africa grew beautifully, and we had this magnificent tomato. So in Italy, a tomato would grow to this size, in Zambia, to this size. And we could not believe. And we were telling the Zambians, look how easy agriculture is. Where the tomatoes were nice and ripe and red, overnight, some 200 hippos came out of the, from the river, and they ate everything. And we said to the Zambians, my God, the hippos!
And so, of course, on from there to explain his idea and his thinking. But how do you explain? Explanation is actually really hard. I mean, look, if the task of a speaker is to build an idea in the audience's mind, that's actually what explanation is. And how do you do it? The only way to do it is to use pieces that already exist in those minds. That's how you have to do it, which means you don't use your language, your jargon. You use their language, their concepts. And a key tool in weaving those things together into the right way is to use metaphors. Metaphors show literally the shape of an idea. So when the science writer Jennifer Kahn came to TED, you know, she wanted to explain to us this biotechnology called CRISPR that everyone was talking about and worried about but didn't fully understand. And she said, look, it's a word processor for the genome. You can use CRISPR to cut and paste any gene from any position to another position, or indeed any letter. And we know what a word processor is. And so, okay, I get it, a word processor for the genome. Wow. And come to think of it, yikes. Metaphors are so powerful. So if explanation is the building of an idea in someone's mind, persuasion starts with a little demolition. You have to take out something there that isn't quite right and replace it with a better idea. And one of the key tools there is to show the absurdity of the position, the idea that you're trying to take away. Here's master persuader Dan Pallotta in action. He was trying to persuade us that we should rethink how much we pay people who work for nonprofits.
We have a visceral reaction to the idea that anyone would make very much money helping other people. Interestingly, we don't have a visceral reaction to the notion that people would make a lot of money not helping other people. You know, you want to make $50 million selling violent video games to kids, go for it. We'll put you on the cover of Wired magazine. But if you want to make $500,000 trying to cure kids of malaria, you're considered a parasite yourself.
I mean, if you can give a rhetorical home run like that in your talk, it's going to be remembered for a long time. Stakes are high when you speak. Amazingly, many speakers think they can just wing it. You know, actors rehearse, musicians rehearse. Speakers really should consider rehearsing. It can really make a huge difference. Tim Urban gave a spectacular talk at the last TED on procrastination. Hilarious, insightful, so wonderful. It's already been seen by 4 million people. When he came to the TED offices 3 weeks beforehand to give a preview of the talk, it was a little ropey, frankly. And that ugly experience persuaded him to put in the rehearsal time necessary to make it great. So I'm going to be a little cheeky here and show you the before and after footage. So it starts off in the TED offices and ends on the TED stage, where he tells this story about how he procrastinated for a full year on his thesis before writing the whole thing in 3 days. Here's Tim Urban, before and after.
So, the thing about, there's micro procrastination that we talked about, and then there's macro procrastination. But the fact about that is that they're both in the same box. So that's 72 hours of work, during which I wrote 90 pages, and ran full speed, diving headfirst to hand it in just at the deadline. I thought that was the end of everything. But a week later, I made a call. And it's school. And they said, Tim Urban? And I said, yeah. And they said, we need to talk about your thesis. I said, okay. And they said, that's one we've ever seen. That did not happen.
You see that difference between completely owning a talk and being owned by it? The difference between those two things is night and day. The difference between those two things is rehearsal. But here's the core, honestly, is that none of these are rules. What you have to figure out is how to give the talk the way that's right for you. I mean, physically, there are many different ways that you can do it. For a lot of TED speakers, just standing here with nothing between you and the audience is the way to do it. It's vulnerable. You know, you feel vulnerable, but audiences actually respond to that. But sometimes people want a podium, and that's fine, too, so long as you remember to look up and connect from time to time with the audience. But you can also even, you know, walk a bit if that helps you think, this way, that way, pause sometimes to make a point. You actually can give a talk sitting down. The late, great Oliver Sacks gave a wonderful talk from a chair. Or, if you prefer, you can leap around the stage like Clifford Stoll did. The point is, the only thing that truly matters when you're giving a talk There's really only one thing. It's that you have something worth saying. So your job is to find a way of saying it that is authentic to you. And that's almost it. So it's 10 years now since this technology called online video flickered its way into life, cheered on by a small army of kittens. And most people at the time saw it as kind of a gimmick, but I've come to think of it as public speaking's Gutenberg moment. It was from that moment on, a speaker's words and ideas could ripple out across the internet to thousands, maybe millions of people, which meant that suddenly this ancient art that was forged around our ancestors' campfires suddenly had global scale. So it's no surprise that this has sparked a renaissance in public speaking. There's suddenly so much more reason for people to really figure out how to do this well. And that, I think, means that in this 21st century, we need to pay attention to this art. I call it presentation literacy. It's public speaking adapted for the internet age. I think it should be taught in every school. I think your kids aren't going to spend that much time writing letters to the editor or preparing careful written resumes. They're going to present themselves directly on video. How does an idea change anything? Well, it can't happen when that idea, no matter how brilliant, remains trapped in a single mind. It can't. It's a tragedy that that happens. Ideas are powerful because they spread from mind to mind, and they persuade dozens, hundreds, maybe a million people that they matter. That is why the way in which ideas are shared matters so much. It's not just a piece of knowledge passed on clinically. It's showing someone, this matters. You need to pay attention to this. And so the tragedy of the current conversation that we're all in this connected age is that so often that conversation is dominated by people who don't necessarily have something that insightful to say. And so many people who do have something really wonderful to say leave it unsaid, either because they're unsure about the right way to share their ideas, or maybe just because they're fearful of doing so. And I really believe this state of affairs has to change. If you, right now, have in your head an idea, a piece of knowledge that others would benefit from, I mean, I urge you to have the courage to stand up and say it. It doesn't have to be a scientific discovery that's going to win you a Nobel Prize. You know, even at the next wedding you go to, sharing a piece of meaning or joy can help bring people together, make us all feel more connected. This is what I believe. We humans are still huddling together around a campfire. It's just that now our campfire spans this whole planet. There it is. Here we are. I think the moment's coming where many of you, right here, it'll be your turn to take a deep breath, pluck up courage, stand up, and share what the world needs you to share. I hope you do that. Thank you so much. Please don't hit me with that.
I won't. But thank you for reminding me not to. So thank you, Chris, for sharing your insights with us. I'd like to start off by asking you, is there a TED talk that has influenced how you manage your company?
You know, back in the early 2000s, maybe 2005, Clay Shirky came to TED, and he spoke about the power of collaboration and how the internet was changing all the rules of that. Whether companies should be tight and hold on to things or let go. And I think that actually played a role in the biggest single decision that TED ever made, which was to start to give away its content online. Like, it felt like a mad thing to do because our whole business model depended on people spending thousands of dollars to come to a conference, hear great content. And if you gave that away, wouldn't they stop coming? Some people thought they would. But Clay Shirky, this is the age of openness. And we discovered that this sort of this generosity strategy, if, for want of a better word, if you give stuff away in the connected age, something amazing happens. Your reputation can spread like wildfire around the planet. People respond to it. And so we found that actually demand for the conferences rocketed as a result of doing this. And so that led to us getting obsessed with this idea of giving away whatever you can give away, give away. We ended up giving away our brand in the form of TEDx. We said, look, we can't put on TED conferences everywhere in the world, but you can. So if you want to, let us know and we'll give you our brand, add an X to it, which stands for self-organized, but also TED multiplied. And amazingly, you know, there's now 3,000 events held a year, which our little team couldn't possibly do. So I think there's a causal thread all the way back to Clay Shirky. Mm-hmm.
And that's what started you posting your videos online.
It was a contributing idea. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And were you surprised by that success?
Yeah, definitely. Thrilled, astonished, a little terrified at times.
You'll never change the access rules that you have? Or
no. I mean, I think we all think that TED is to be free for anyone forever. That's our mission.
That's great. One of the speakers that you just featured was Monica Lewinsky, who some might have considered to be a controversial TED speaker. Why was she chosen to speak, and can you list any other controversial speakers and what goes into your decision-making process for those folks?
She was chosen because she had a great idea. You know, she had something that she was passionate about sharing, and we knew that if she could find a way of sharing it, it would get a lot of attention, a lot of spreading mm-hmm. of that idea. It was incredibly hard for her to give this talk mm-hmm. Because the stakes were certainly really high for her. And we worked hard with her, but she ended up, you know, she completely won over the audience. And her talk is about cyberbullying, which is, you know, she was kind of victim zero on the internet for that. And so many kids now, you know, go through real trauma. There have been suicides. It's a real problem in our modern era. And so I think this is a lifeline to a lot of people, and it's been thrilling to see how many have watched it.
Mm-hmm. So do you give a lot of coaching to speakers? Do speakers come to you and say, I have an idea, and you help them sort of frame it or modify it or how to best to express it?
Yes, we do. It's different in every case, but over the last few years especially, the stakes of getting your talk right have kind of risen, and mm-hmm. people see, oh my goodness, if I get this right, maybe millions of people will watch this talk. So they're actually willing to put in sometimes literally months of work in preparation for it. And we've, over the years, you know, I mean, this is why the book got written. It's because we've been through this process so many times now. We've learned from speakers how to do this a bit and what works and what doesn't. And we are being intercepted right now. Oh, no, here we go. These are your next questions.
Surprise me. Sorry.
Security.
Yes.
what works and what doesn't. And you know, there are risks with over-preparation and trying to help people get to the point where they really know a talk, but in the moment they can own it and give it in a human, connected way, not in a robotic way. That's one of the things that we're trying to get more nuanced on. What I would say is the more that we've done this, the more we've learned is that there are no rules, mm-hmm. that there's ideas and tools that you have to apply in a nuanced way in different situations. And what we want is this rich variety of talks. We do not want all talks sounding the same. Oh, no.
What about another controversial speaker, maybe Edward Snowden?
Oh, Edward Snowden, he was definitely controversial. You know, hero, traitor, you know, very, very strong opinions on him. And also slightly hard to bring to the stage since he was in Moscow.
Right.
So we brought him in via a telepresence robot. And funnily enough, it was actually the idea of doing that struck him because he's a guy who loves technology. Wasn't one of the reasons why we persuaded him to come. And it turned out really powerful. After the talk, he was kind of roaming the hallways, and people were kind of taking selfies with Snowden, and it was great. And then, of course, having done that, we had to invite the NSA to come on and, you know, have a sort of counter thing. So it was for me personally, a very intense TED, because mm-hmm. It was definitely pushing my own comfort level. But it's such an important debate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk about something called a through line. Can you expand on that idea and why that's important for giving a great talk?
So I said that the core way to think of a talk is that it's to transfer this idea, to figure out what your idea is and make that the gift. That means that you want to build your entire talk around that idea. It becomes your through line. You know, so many talks that you hear first time, it's what happens is, I think a speaker's tried to say, here are the many things that I would love to share with this audience. I'm excited about that piece of work. I'm excited about that piece. So I'm going to cram them all in and share them all as best I can. And the experience is that it's a bit unsatisfying. It sort of rambles. You don't know where you're going. I don't quite get what... So at each step of the way of the talk, you need to first of all set up the idea. What's the problem? Why is this an issue? Why does it matter? Why should you care? You know, here are some attempts to solve it. Here's why they didn't work. But then I discovered this, and then that gave this insight. And look, what if we explained it this way? Now, what would that mean? Well, here's an example. Here's another example. Here's the implications of that. All these things are sort of threaded together through one through line. But it's such a helpful concept to say for a talk, what is your through line? When you, those ideas that, when I showed those TED speakers with those ideas, those sentences, that was their through line, and everything in the talk kind of linked to that in some way.
You have a rule around religious figures and political figures that you don't invite them to the TED stage. Is that something that you might change with time?
Well, we actually have a rule for our TEDx licensees that we ask them not to put on talks that are, you know, religious or political. And the reason for that is that 9 times out of 10 that goes wrong. What happens is that people shift from thinking, listening mode to kind of tribal defensive mode. And instead of having an exchange of ideas, what you have is two people shouting at each other. Or, you know, it's just our identities behave very strangely in certain areas. Religion and politics are really important topics. And occasionally we have brought religious figures, political figures to the stage. What we're looking for, though, are non-political talks. We're looking for talks that reframe an issue outside the normal lens so that we don't press buttons that make people shut down and start getting angry. Besides, you know, we've got cable. That's 24/7 people. You know, there's enough of that. We're sort of the antidote. And I think fundamentally Ted believes that the role of ideas in our culture is vastly and tragically underplayed. Mm-hmm. Politicians come and go. Ideas last forever. And so we're almost the antidote to 24/7 shouting heads, mm-hmm. and which means it's not formally taboo. It's just that we have to be really careful how we do that.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question from the audience. How will you protect the freshness of TED Talks and the thousands of TEDx's around the world? And won't the public experience of TED Talks sort of start to fatigue? So how will you protect that?
Too many TED Talks, therefore everyone's going to feel fatigue. So that would be true if the world of knowledge was limited. Mm-hmm. If there were only 1,422 ideas in the world and you had to hear them again and again, it would be a bit like, oh, God, I almost said a bit like going to church, but I'm sorry. You see, now I immediately pissed off half the audience.
Look what you did.
I didn't mean that. I actually
can't take
had
you
a
anywhere.
Lot of joy in my life from going to church. But that's not what knowledge is. Right. Knowledge, the more we know, the greater our ignorance becomes. You know, knowledge, you think of, we're in this bubble, right? We're surrounded by this sphere of unknown, and we gradually press out against it, and you push it, and we gradually make the circle the sphere we're in a little bigger. And at every step of the stage, you discover more wonders, more mysteries, more questions. And so this is the whole thrill about knowledge, is the more you immerse yourself, the more you ask, the more you learn, the more you want to learn, the more interesting each new piece of knowledge is. So no, the answer is no. There are some risks in brand dilution and things going wrong, for sure, which we've embraced with TEDx. We said it's absolutely worth the risk to have a few things screw up for the sake of this amazing diversity of content that we get. But knowledge getting boring, no way.
Okay.
Speaking of screw-ups, are there any behind-the-scenes stories of catastrophes that might be interesting or funny to share?
Or painful?
Or painful.
Does that count?
Yeah, that's very, yeah.
Yeah. So, too many. There's a story I tell in the book about this physicist who was a brilliant lecturer who came to TED one year and gave us, he was giving us a talk about black holes and some new science on it. It was an incredibly interesting in principle. And he got halfway through it, and it was going quite well, but then he sort of got stuck a bit, and he did what I just did. He said, hang on a second, put out his phone and started reading, oh, yeah, yeah, and he started continuing. And I thought, phew, and then, but then it came out again, and again, and you could hear his voice starting to tighten up a bit like this. And so I go on the stage, give him some water, it's okay, you know. And he drank the water and drank more water, downed a whole bottle, he was sort of, sweat was dripping. And his talk kind of imploded. I mean, it was so horrible to see. And the thing is, this was my fault. I really think that what happened there was that we encouraged him to give the kind of talk he shouldn't have given. We encouraged him to memorize a talk. Mm. You know, like a lot of TED speakers do memorize their talk, and they think that's the best way of getting the words out in the way that they want them and so forth. He didn't speak that way. He was a brilliant communicator of science. He spoke in the moment he knew a subject so well. And so I learned from that moment that we really have to get a much more nuanced way of guiding speakers. And today we try and help people figure out early on, are you a memorizer or are you able to speak in the moment? If you're a memorizer, by the way, you have to really memorize it. You can't give a talk that sounds memorized. That's a disaster. You've got to get past that. We really think there's this thing called the uncanny valley where if you memorize, you go for a bit where you sound robotic. But if you can get through that and know the talk so that you know it as well as you know the song Happy Birthday, it's just there, right? You can speak it at double speed with the television on. Then you can come out in the moment. And you're not struggling to remember. You're struggling to say, who do I want to address now? You look interesting. This really matters. And you give the talk passionately knowing it. Anyway. That was a disaster, but it led to us learning something.
So another question from the audience. What is the best way to reduce your fear on stage when you're speaking?
Well, the best way to reduce your fear is not to do it on stage. It's to do it beforehand. It's to say fear is here for a reason. You know, the reason we have fear to persuade us to act. That's its biological purpose. And in this case, it should drive you to preparing properly, to learning. So if you're too embarrassed to give a talk to a friend, give it to yourself. Give it to your smartphone. Record it. And then give it to a few friends. And then repeat and repeat until you start to see people's eyes light up a bit. And then tell yourself that feeling in you actually isn't fear. It's budding. It's building excitement. And come out on stage feeling fear. It's actually good to have a bit of energy. I was feeling nervous, you know, seeing this lovely crowd here when I came on. It helped. It's energizing. And then if the worst comes to the worst, you know, have a backup plan. Have your water over there and notes. Do what I did. You know, you kind of lose your way a bit. Go over, have a sip of water, and be honest with the audience. Say, that was a screw-up, wasn't it? Or, you know, I actually do get a little nervous public speaking. Sorry, forgive this. You know, normal service will be reserved soon, will be resumed soon. Whatever it is. And people embrace nervous speakers if you're straightforward with them. So that's what I'd say. It's not a reason not to speak.
My coaching for folks is don't apologize, but sort of have a canned something that you say. And someone on my staff always says, one moment, please. Your call is very important to us. And then that just sort of helps her gain her composure again. Which TED Talk would you say has had the most visible impact on the world? A question from the audience.
Wow. Good Lord. Well, I would probably have to go with Ken Robinson's talk on education and the need for creativity in education. It's been seen 38 million times. And it's actually, I think, a deeply profound talk for now. It's now 10 years since he gave that talk. But for now, when you think of this world being taken over by robots and automation and machine learning and all the rest of it, what are humans for? You know, I mean, there's plenty of human things, but creativity is first and foremost among them. And so, of course, we should nurture creativity in school.
So speaking of Sir Ken and his presentation about schools, do you think that schools or universities should switch to the TED model of shorter lectures or shorter classes?
I don't know about that. I think there's absolutely a case to dig in deep. TED does never claims to be the sort of the final word on anything. We see ourselves as we're battling the attention madness that's out there. We're trying to persuade people that they should take ideas seriously and present them in a way that they're accessible and fun. So we're kind of the gateway drug to knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. Bring them. But then once you're addicted, yeah, go to university and school and do those things their way. But I do think that there's a real opportunity for any teacher, whether it's school or university, to take a bit of my job on, be a curator. Realize that we're in an era where, for the first time, you can bring the world's greatest teachers to your students. How great is that? Mm-hmm. So don't do all the teaching, all the instruction yourself. Bring in the world's greatest minds and let them inspire your kids. And then that opens up more time for you to do one-on-one and be the coach and the mentor and so forth. So I think there's room for education to change actually quite a lot, but not to replace.
Mm-hmm. No. We call that the flipped classroom.
So the flipped classroom is a powerful idea, mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Sort of the slippery slope that your parents warn you about with drugs. Let's see, can you talk about some of your younger TED speakers? Is there any age requirement or any particularly memorable young speakers that you've had?
There's no age requirement. It's like it's good if you can speak a sentence or two, mm-hmm. So probably like three.
So what's the youngest?
Older than three.
What's the youngest you've had?
I think actually on the main TED stage, 11 or 12 is about the youngest. We had this amazing kid, Richard Tuari, who's a Kenyan boy who grew up in a Maasai village, looking after his family's animals and trying to protect them from lions. And he invented this solar system to flash lights around to scare away the lions. Incredible. He taught himself electronics by dismantling his parents' radio. And when we met him, he could hardly speak. He was so nervous. You would think, no way could this kid give a talk. You know, his idea mattered so much. We told him that if he could just pluck up a little bit of courage and say things the right way and clearly, he was going to get people excited. And there was this life in him. So 6 months later, after some work and on it, he jumped on a plane for the first time, came to California. We slotted him in between Bill Gates and Sergey Brin, and
no pressure.
And he lit up the room. I mean, he was amazing. He gave an amazing talk and won a huge standing ovation. And, again, if he can do it, you can do it.
Yeah. So how much vetting of the speakers do you do before they are on the stage?
Criminal background checks, slap down search. We want to know that they have something to say that is really interesting and important and that they're a credible communicator of that information. Like ideally, you want them to be the best person in the world to reveal that particular thinking or idea. Mm-hmm. But there's no hard and fast rules on this. We certainly want people to be credible, to be speaking, not to be sharing stuff that just doesn't stack up or that is sort of plagiarized or something like that. But beyond that, it's just finding the right mix for any given conference. Mm-hmm.
A lot of people say and you know too often. Are there any habits that you can recommend to get rid of these or other common mistakes that people make?
I say and you know too often. And so if anyone knows how to get rid of that, could you see me later? I'd be very grateful. It's good. I mean, I think rehearsal really helps. Knowing what you're going to say matters a lot. You saw Tim Urban, who's truly an incredible speaker and thinker, but in rehearsal, he was still not there, and he was umming and ahhing a lot. I do that. Lots of people do that. So I think it's knowing, it's really being familiar with your material is the biggest single cure of that. And perhaps just recording yourself, because you may not even be aware that you're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Is there someone that you hope to see on the TED stage?
Maybe you? I don't know. We've got an invite out to the Pope currently.
Really, that's cool.
I think he would be interesting. Speaking of never having religious figures on the stage. Here's the funny thing about TED, though, is that usually the best talks are from people who no one's ever heard of. Ideas can come from anywhere. And I love the fact that TED has had this role of sort of introducing to the world a different type of celebrity, mm-hmm. you know? Celebrities who actually have a mind, and I'm not saying that no celebrities have minds, but many celebrities aren't there because of their ability to think beautifully. They're there for lots of other wonderful reasons. The world needs celebrities who are there for their ideas, because the world needs great ideas. If we're to make it, you know, the ideas are out there probably to solve every single one of the problems we face. They're just not widely distributed.
It's really cool how many intellectual celebrity careers have been launched because of TED. So I'm thinking of Amy Cuddy, a really fantastic Harvard researcher, you know, launched an amazing career because of her TED Talk. And Sheryl Sandberg, who we all know is a local leader, you know, was a strong local leader, but then also launched an incredible global career because of her TED Talk. Are there other people that have graced the stage that have really launched because of what they've done with you?
I think most speakers who have, you know, a book in the works or something like that have seen that they've got a lot more visibility from doing a talk. I wouldn't want to overclaim that, because you can never say what would have happened. I mean, I'm a great believer that ideas, if an idea whose time has come, its time has come. But we're certainly thrilled seeing people get that greater visibility. Someone like Susan Cain, you know, who's an introvert, I mean, she gave a great talk, which has certainly helped her, but I think she would have been just fine without it as well. She had a great book. Mm-hmm. But people, you know, I mean, if you're lucky, whatever, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 people might buy your book. It is possible now in the sort of, you know, online to reach a lot more people than that with your idea in condensed form. So there's a role to play, and it's very exciting when it happens.
Mm-hmm. That's great. If you weren't working on TED, what do you think you'd be involved with?
Oh.
Good question from our audience.
Well, I mean, I was a media entrepreneur. I love mass media. I love the fact that communication spreads, you know, one, whether it's a magazine, a television station, a website, or whatever, your human intent can be amplified by the millions. So it would be some other way of doing that. I think there are so many cool things happening online right now that would be fun to play in. But the truth is, it's a completely hypothetical question, because I'm in love with TED still. I don't think I'll be doing anything else while I'm still working. So. Mm-hmm. I don't spend a lot of time on that one.
You did found more than 100 successful magazines and websites.
Can and
you...
about 100 unsuccessful
okay.
ones as well.
That's actually my question.
Okay.
Are there any failures that you've encountered along the way that we could learn from? From any of those missteps?
Many. Today's vegetarian. Oh, I knew thee well. When the internet first launched, I was first was taking off. I think in like 94, we were in. I came to America after starting the career in the UK, and we tried to launch a magazine called The Net that was about the internet. And we spent a lot of money on it, and it was too edgy and too. It just wasn't mainstream enough and didn't work. Bombed. It led to something good. I mean, I think the key is to learn from your mistakes. We use the subscription list from that to launch Business 2.0, which did go on to become a success. But I think as an entrepreneur, if you can take the stance, if you're in a type of business where it's possible to fail regularly, that's the best way to succeed, because you learn from each of them. And even though they're gut-wrenching at the time, if you learn from them, it helps you get wiser for the next one, and actually to get a lot more joy from the next one.
Mm-hmm. What is the difference between, you mentioned this a little bit, but also TED, TEDx, and then the TED Institute? You want to say the difference between those?
Sure. So TED is the main conference and the website that we own and operate and do. TEDx are these self-organized events around the world. There's 8 or 9 of them every day. And there are some rules and tools, but we don't control them. All those events are done by the amazing TEDx organizers. Are there any TEDx organizers here tonight? Hero, 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 hero. We adore you and we're amazed by you guys, truly. TED Institute is our attempt to bring TED to corporations. Most media companies have this relationship with companies that I really dislike. It's based on ambush marketing. The idea is we're going to seduce an audience to come, and then we're going to throw you in front of them when they're not, you know, when they're least aware of it. You know, we're going to put a pre-roll video in front of the video they really want to see. You know, they won't hate you that much, you know, and thank you for the money. I hate that basis for a relationship. What we're trying to build at TED is a relationship with companies based on an exchange of knowledge. You know, that's our mantra. We think TED knowledge can help, you know, inspire certain things in companies, and we absolutely think that companies have so much knowledge to share with the world. Most of the interesting things that happen in the world often start in companies. And so TED Institute is a TED event that we curate at a company. It's a paid-for event, but we try and apply all the same standards we would to TED speakers to get a great lineup. And some of those talks have been amazing to see.
How do you choose which presentations make it online? So there's TED, TEDx, and then the TED Institute. Which ones go on the website?
So we try and pull from the entire pool and just pick the best one available to us on that day. Sometimes there's a timing reason why something needs to be now. But there's way more talks out there than we have the ability to post on the site without it getting overly cluttered, I think. So not every solid talk makes it, to be sure. It's a matter of judgment. It's like saying how did the editors of the New York Times decide which stories to put on the front page or which op-eds from the many that they receive to publish. It's ultimately a matter of judgment.
Do you ever get any backlash? Why did you choose that physicist to talk about this idea instead of this other physicist?
Sure. There's occasionally backlash. There's occasionally jealousy. There's occasionally
drama.
Errors in what we put out and so forth that we need to work on. All of this.
Is there drama and intrigue? And how come my video wasn't posted or anything?
I mean, people are understanding. They understand it's a curation process. I mean, there's no algorithm to it. There's no absolutely right proven way to do it. It's a matter of judgment. And by and large, people support the choices that we've made over time. But absolutely, there are people who are disappointed that maybe they gave a talk at TED and it wasn't one of the ones that the audience particularly responded to, so we haven't yet posted it. People don't like that. That's upsetting.
Yeah. What do you perceive is the difference between knowledge and wisdom? It's a question from the audience.
I mean, a computer can have knowledge, right? You can have a computer could read all of Wikipedia, have a lot of knowledge, plus a lot of errors, but not that many. Wisdom, I guess, is knowing how to use that knowledge in a way that I think implied in wisdom is the notion that it's using that knowledge in a way that respects humanity, respects deep human values. That's what people like to think of it, and it comes usually from, deep experience and just knowing how the world works. And I would love to think that, some TED speakers really offer that. You know, when we say ideas worth spreading, wisdom is those are some of the deepest encapsulation of what we mean by an idea. It's usable knowledge, actionable knowledge, inspiring knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Is there a place, do you think, for talks that are of different lengths? The TED Talks are 15 minutes? 18 minutes?
18 and less.
18 and less. Do you think you'll have a format, you'll have 30 minutes or an hour or 3 minutes or any other variation?
We might. The 18 minutes has worked well for us. It's a natural human attention span. It's long enough to say something that matters, but short enough to have a coffee break and to have a chance of it actually going viral on the internet. So it's worked well for us, but we have plenty of talks that are quite a bit shorter than that, and I think there is a case for some talks that go a lot longer. It's just it's less likely that they will carve out a role in the attention war that we're in. But I'm actually open to it.
Mm-hmm. Going back to your book, which is just today is on the Jenny, New York Times bestseller.
Oh, yeah. List. No, it is. Yeah. Yeah. That was a nice surprise. Won't be published yet. Don't tell anyone.
Oh, don't tell
it's
anyone.
It's a secret.
Well, wait. If it's not published yet, how did it get to be number three on the how-to advice list from the New York Times bestseller?
Because our publisher was told that by the New York Times. But that's coming up. But we're excited about that. That's great. By the way, this is a galley. Where it's published in hardback. This is Jenny's galley with a note in it. But the actual book looks a little different to that.
Oh, it does?
Yeah.
All right.
Like it doesn't bend.
It doesn't bend.
No.
Well, that's good. It's the water from the bathtub. So in your book, you talk about the structure of presentations. Do you want to give a quick summary of that or how you structure and format? What's the easiest or best way to do that?
It goes to the through line thing again. If you think about what a speaker's trying to do, you're trying to take an idea, which is this complex thing that's probably represented in the brain in many sort of hierarchies and so forth, in a one-dimensional sequence of words. That's hard to do. And so a talk needs a structure where those words, if you like, reflect the shape of the idea a bit more. So again, you need to say when you're doing a talk, what is this, what service, what's the purpose of this sentence? Is this amplifying the idea or is it giving a counterexample? So many times you hear things said in talk, you're just not quite sure where the speaker's going with it. So it's giving a structure, and there's no one structure that's right. Some talks are literally, I'm going to tell you a story, and at the end of the talk, I will finish the story, and you will find some meaning from that story because it's been told very carefully. And that is, the structure is just like that. Other talks will say, I want to share with you five interconnected pieces of work that I've done, and we're going to start here, and we're actually going to end there. And the structure of that talk is kind of like a circle where you end up where you started. But you should have a clear, I think even visual sense of what the structure of your talk is. And the thing that describes that visual sense, that is your through line.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to prepare the presentation that you gave tonight, your talk?
A lifetime, I think we should say. I had a moment of panic 10 days ago when I suddenly realized that if I was going to come on tour with, public speaking guide, people might expect to talk. And so I thought, help. Happily, we've got this archive of great video footage. So 10 speakers came to the rescue and provided some little nuggets of gold. So it was 2 weeks ago it started seriously, and I gave it to some people at the office in presentation, and they all kind of rolled their eyes and said, that's not really very good yet. And so I tried again.
How many iterations did you do?
I mean, my email says Tour Talk version 7 on it. There've been a few, and then there's lots of smaller iterations on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any other stories from the book that you want to illustrate for us?
How much time do you have?
We have 5 minutes.
We have 5 minutes. Goodness me.
Four.
What story will I tell you? I'll tell you. One of the book starts off with some ways of speaking that really aren't recommended. Like there are definitely talk styles that aren't good, and one of them is the sales pitch. And I had this, I think it was my second, possibly my first year at TED, when I invited a speaker. It was this great consultant, you know, very well known, famous author, and I was all excited about what he was going to do. And he started his talk and said, I want to show you a company that's been extraordinarily successful. And he showed some stats. And he said, and now another company that's been extraordinarily successful, more stats. And here's a third company that's been extraordinarily successful. Now, you may wonder what these have in common. Well, each of these companies has worked with me to understand my technique. And I almost threw up, but I waited a bit. And then, you know, he kept going in this mode for a couple more minutes, not telling us anything about his method, but why it was so great. And I finally, I interrupted him, and everyone was listening. It was like, I would really like you to move on, actually give us an example of your method in action. This is sounding just a little bit like an ad. And he goes, I couldn't possibly do it. This method takes 3 days to explain. In 15 minutes, all I can do. I said, no, you can give us something. I know you can give us. Anyway, and the audience started getting into it. It was a very stressful moment. But the audience were hating this. And so it was actually, from my point of view, it was actually a good moment because people said, okay, Chris is on our side. That was good. And don't give a sale. You know, that kind of sales pitch is so counterproductive. It makes people hate you, and your reputation actually goes down. So the way you, if you want to advance your agenda, you do that through generosity. You know, you figure out what it is you can give people, and trust in that human dynamic that generosity evokes a response. Brian Stevenson came to TED. He is a lawyer who fights against the crazy incarceration in this country. And when he came to TED first time, he was fighting to get juveniles out of adult jails. He was in the middle of a Supreme Court case. His organization was in urgent need of $1 million. And he said nothing about this in his talk. He just told his story. He told why it mattered. And when he sat down, you know, it was the longest standing ovation there's ever been at TED. People stood and cheered him for, I think, for like, I want to say 4 or 5 minutes, you know. And I had kind of had no choice the next day. I just said, look, we could actually, there's this case going on. Could we raise money for it? And just from a show of hands and about 15 minutes from the audience, he went away with $1.2 million. But he never asked for it. He never came close to asking for it. You know, he shared an idea, he shared his passion, and people responded.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Beautiful. I get little chills. Any closing thoughts? We have time for just some wrap-up thoughts.
I mean, look, here we are in the Bay Area. This region is full of amazing people, thoughtful people. If I had a brain scanner here and I could see what was going on inside your minds, there's a very real chance I could know the future. I mean, there are ideas here that have potentially huge consequence if they were able to ripple out across the world a bit. I also bet that a lot of people here are fearful of public speaking. Most people are. And that you it's not something you think of doing. So I would say, you know, try it. Like, we're in this connected era. It's never mattered more that we give this a shot. Because what you have could help nudge the future. So please try.
Beautiful. Thank you. I hope you've enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Chris Anderson, curator of TED, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio and on the web. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 113 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was great. Really appreciate it. That was lovely.